Summer concert season is almost upon us, and if you're heading out to a country show, it'll be all about the boots. With seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more, Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and a friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there is no in-store experience quite like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges. And they ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today. You've heard me talk about my dog Tucker a lot on this podcast, and it's hard to imagine our family now without the joy that this little field spaniel has brought to our daily lives. That's when we were approached about advertising Superfood Complete on the show, and I said, well, yes, of course. Actress Katherine Heigl has helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, and she is seeing more and more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Dogs across America, just like my dog Tucker, are trying Superfood Complete and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/Zabe and order right now to get up to 50% off your regularly priced order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com. That's BadlandsRanch.com/Zabe today. Today on the Zabecast, author and bourbon expert Fred Minnick. We'll get bourbon 101 today. Myths and misconceptions, snobs and douchebags, and how Japan saved the American bourbon industry. And we'll cut that bourbon with a splash of sports, the lollygagging Nats, quarterback tears of a clown, and more. If you've got 45 minutes to kill, then buckle up and let's go!
Here we go!
Wednesday, July 25th, 2018. Thank you so much for the download. Looking forward to today's Zabecast. Today's Zabecast will be the last of the week. Just a warning, I know. Another three-day week. Yes, another three-day week. You know, I got to get my me time here. I will be actually in Wisconsin for the Bob and Brian charity golf outing. Annually, the largest single-day outing in the state of Wisconsin. All benefits the MAC Fund, the Midwest Athletes Against Childhood Cancer Fund. It's a great cause, and it's a great event, and it's good to see my boys up there, for whom you may already know me from them. In fact, many of you only know me from Bob and Brian. Others know me from D.C. Others know me from having national shows. Some of you are just knowing me from being subscribers to the Zabecast. Who knows? But yes, I've been going up there for almost 22 years plus. I mean, I used to live, you know, many years ago before I moved back here to D.C. by way of Charlotte. I lived in Northbrook, Illinois. And that was when I was working for the then One-on-One Sports Radio Network, circa 1994. And I got hooked up with these guys up there, these FM shock jocks, even though they're not shock jocks. They don't do bits either. But they are the dominant morning show in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And they started a golf tournament 28 years ago, I want to say. Maybe more, in which they said they wanted a day off. They're like, well, we should do a golf tournament. And their program director at the time said, our listeners don't golf. They go to rock shows, they go to concerts, they buy T-shirts, and that's it. Well, he was kind of right in that most of their listeners golf badly. But they do love this outing. They love to go play golf once a year. And they get all their cargo shorts, and they get sunburned as hell and drunk as hell, and it's just a great fun event. I do not get sick of it. And, of course, I then get to work in some other great rounds at great golf courses. Very lucky to be playing Aaron Hills again this year. Jim Lombardo, thank you for hosting us, getting us out there. Hopefully my knock on wood flight does not get delayed. That'll be on Thursday. And then on Saturday, so then Friday is the tournament. Saturday, I host my Bloody Horns at the Bull. Thank you, Dave Bachman, owner and operator of the Bull. Fine course, incredible course. Jack Nicklaus design, rock and roll, hard as Chinese trigonometry. That's on Saturday. And then on Sunday, I'm going to be playing the incredible, incomparable Black Wolf Run River course, which is part of the Kohler complex of courses. They've got Black Wolf Run River and Meadows Valley. Those were there first. That's at the American Club in Kohler, Wisconsin. And then you've got Whistling Straits and the Irish course, which is on the coast there. And it's an incredible four golf courses right there in, of all places, Kohler, Wisconsin. You really can go play. You can fashion an incredible golf trip in Wisconsin now. And they've got a new place further up north called Sand Valley, which is aiming to be like the Bandon Dunes of the Midwest because it's a Crenshaw core design and it's very minimalist and it's based on these incredible sand dunes that exist in the middle of the state of Wisconsin. But it's up there. I mean, it's several more hours north, and I just haven't had a chance to go up there. So there's my golf plans for the weekend. And then we'll be back next week. Oh, wait a minute. I'm not coming back till Monday, so I'm not sure how I'm going to get the Monday Zabecast now. So this week, 3 shows. Next week, 4 shows. Boo! All right. Maybe I'll get one done somehow on the road and post it somehow for Monday. Not sure how I'm going to do that. Don't you want quality? Don't you need the quality of me here with my sound effects and everything that you've come to know and love? Or do you just want me talking into a microphone? You know, I've got standards. Standards. All right, let's do some sports real quick, and then we'll get to our friend Fred Minnick, who has written several books on bourbon. I've been waiting to get him on for some time now. I figured dead of summer, just before football starts, perfect time. Whether you like bourbon or not, I think you're going to learn something today if you keep your mind open on this. The Nationals continue to struggle, and that's a gentle word for suck. They're now 2 games under 500 after losing in 10 innings last night on a bases loaded sacrifice fly. Bryce Harper did not play. He had a tummy ache. I'm sorry, a stomach virus. And you had benched the Nats benched Trey Turner for not running out a bunt that ended up going fair and he thought was going to be foul. He just quit on the play. Can't do it. You can't do it. Not when you are supposedly struggling to save your season. There is some chance that the Nats could make a rally and win the division, but the odds are getting longer and longer all the time. In fact, if I could look up their POF number, POF MLB, I think this is on FanGraphs. Playoff, here we go. Playoff odds, FanGraphs baseball. Let's just see, because about 2 weeks, 2.5, 3 weeks ago, when the Nats were still about 6 games back, I kept checking their playoff chances, and it kept showing an amazing 56% chance to make the playoffs somehow. And I just didn't understand it, even though the standings are updated every day and supposedly the calculation is updated every single day. I think a lot of it is just based on, well, they're still a good team. They still have good players. And once they get certain guys back from the DL, they're going to be good. They still have a good chance. Well, let's see here. Oh, the Nats, they're down to 45%. On the POF, and they're now no longer favored to win the division. They are 33.6% to win the division, which is amazing because they're 7 games back of the Nationals. Or excuse me, 7 games back of the Phillies. They're 7 games back of the Phillies, and they're 6 games back of the Braves. 7-6. I mean, seriously, they're going to overcome twin 7-6 deficits? I don't see it. So now it comes down to the question of should they trade Bryce Harper, because the trade deadline's coming. I think it's pretty certain that he is not going to re-sign with the Nats. I think there's a strong argument that whatever he and Boris wants is way too much fucking money. So sorry, but no, we're not going to pay him $300-400 million. So let's move on. So if really the Bryce Harper era is about to sunset, let's get something in return. Now, it'll seem like a surrender flag. It'll seem like, well, that's it. We're done. We're out. We're not. We're not going to. You know, we have no chance of making up the 6 and 7 game deficits. But that's not necessarily the case, because if you get an extra arm or a reliever in this Bryce Harper deal, and if you get one of the youngsters like Soto or Robles to step up, or Michael A. Taylor to give you 80% of whatever Harper's production has been, and it's mostly been home runs and power, not average, then you're not necessarily any worse off this year than you were when Bryce Harper was on the team, especially if you get an arm back that can, you know, contribute right now. But then you got to spin it as, hey, this was tough, and we love Bryce, and he was the face of the team, but you know what? We didn't think he was going to re-sign, and we still want to make a push for the playoffs, and this gives us an extra arm or an extra this to do so, and we're gonna make up for Bryce Harper's production somewhere else. That's a tricky sell. That's a tough one. You got to, if you're Mike Rizzo, who I don't think has it in him, and if you're the learners, who I don't think want to do this, then You gotta spin it. You gotta really sell it in a way that's believable. It's not totally easy. But this season's over. I mean, come on. Over. Got some emails here. Thank you for your feedback all the time. This email comes from Kevin Brelenthin. Zabe, if I could nominate somebody for FTG, it's the person who gathers at the gate at the airport, right in line before your group is called. You're standing 5 feet from the gate. You will not fucking miss the plane. Fuck that guy. Get out of my way. P.S. Thank you, Zabe, for doing your podcast and being my daily dose of therapy. Well, you're welcome on that. I appreciate it. Gargantu Bracket Brad Turner, emailed me to say, Zabe, I finally determined what your podcast is. It's an adult sports-oriented version of Mr. Rogers. You highlight the general sports happenings, and then you open the door, kick off your shoes, and discuss it with whatever neighbor stops by. Oh, it's Mr. McFeely. Come on in. It's fucking awesome, says Brad.
Awesome!
Monday's show is literally the exact same conversation my buddy and I had at lunch over a few beers. Now look, just monetize this sucker. I would easily pay Netflix money for this content. Sincerely, Brad. We're working on it. We're working on it. We got some ideas in the hopper. But yeah, got to keep doing it. Matt Moeller emails me to say, thank you for that, by the way. Should I do the show with a red sweater like Mr. Rogers?
I know this, Mr. Rogers didn't feel the need to say the F word all the time. Potty mouth this. You know, I'm trying to listen to this podcast with my kids in the car. Ah,
a big mistake. You can't. And the reason that I do sprinkle in, hopefully, judicious amounts of F-bombs and whatever, is to differentiate the product, first and foremost, from my over-the-air show. And secondly, because this is how I talk. This is how a lot of people talk. Not everybody. But a lot of people. Now, some guys like our friend, the Big Ginger, Mr. Murray, I think goes out of his way to drop F-bombs, and that's okay. He's an angry young man, but I love him anyway. We're going to dial that back. And if I'm getting too much with the random F-bombs, then let me know. I will print up coupon books if needed that say, okay, here's a coupon, like I do with Murray. Like, okay, I used one there. Let me go ahead and save this last one for something good. Matt Moeller emails me to say, subject... meow. Zabe, does this seem about right? All the tiger slurpage during the broadcast on Sunday was ridiculous, by the way. Oh, speaking of that, the British Open numbers are in, and they were fantastic. As a matter of fact, the British Open got the highest rating it's had in like 18 years. Darren Revell, here we go. Final round of the Open, 6.48 million viewers. That is the most in 18 years. Tiger's win at St. Andrews 18 years ago in 2000 had 8.56 million viewers. Now you could say, "Ooh, golf has lost 2 million viewers in that time." Okay. But remember, 2000, peak of Tiger Mania. Tiger was on his way to winning, or not winning, he was on his way to completing the Tiger Slam, That would be, this was the second leg of the Tiger Slam, because let's see, he won the 2000 U.S. Open at Pebble, 2000 British at St. Andrews, 2000 PGA Championship at Valhalla in extra holes against Bob May, and then the next year won the Masters, 2001, in that thrilling duel in extra holes yet again with Chris DeMarco. I think. I'm pretty sure, don't quote me on that. I mean, that's peak Tiger right there. That he's bringing eyeballs to the set that had never watched golf before. So it's unrealistic to think that you'd get the same number in total viewers, but still, best number in 18 years. Anyway, back to the email here from Matt Moeller. He says, the Tiger slurpage during the broadcast was just ridiculous on Sunday. For example, he had a bad shot that luckily didn't fall in a bunker, and the best that David Faraday could muster was, oh, that was so close to being perfect. Thankfully, Johnny Miller stepped in and said, well, I don't know about that. While Molinari hit two of the best shots I've ever seen, two untouchable pins, which were probably the best two shots of the tournament, and all any of the announcers could muster was crickets. Tiger's average to below average shots were deemed brilliant, while his truly brilliant shots by others, were deemed good or barely commented on with things like, well, he needed a bounce. Of course, dude played that bounce perfectly with the perfect execution, but they made it seem like pure luck when it wasn't being done by Tiger. Meow. Signed, Matt Moeller. All right. There is some of that going on. There's no question. There is no question there is some Tiger slurpage, and there is no question that the announcers get sucked into things. The one example that kind of drove me a bit batty was Saturday. Tiger steps up on number 9 and pulls out driver. And this is, you know, a rare occasion. He's only hitting like 4 or 5 drivers around when he could be hitting upwards of 14. And so he hits he pulls out driver, and already the announcer's like, he's going to hit driver. They're all excited. He takes a mighty lash at the driver. It makes the sound that tour players' drivers make, which is a whoosh and a splat and a schlink that is a medley of sounds that you and I can't make those sounds with our drivers. Oh, no. We don't have the club head speed. We don't have the integrity of strike to do that. But they do. Literally, as the ball's in the air, the announcers are gushing. Oh, wow. He really, what a great shot that was. And you're like watching going, okay, where's it going? Left rough. It didn't matter. He put it in the left rough. It was just, oh, my God, Tiger hit a driver. Wow. So literally then, within 2 minutes of that swing and that reaction from the announcers, Jordan Spieth, who's, you know, a pretty big star in the game nowadays, not as big as Tiger, tees off on number 1, and he hits a missile. You know, Jordan Spieth is not particularly long, but he's not short either. For just an average-sized, skinny, you know, kid, suburban kid, he can hit it. He can hit it. He hits a missile on 1 that threads this narrow chute between a pot bunker and a ridge, and then it funnels down to the green. This thing, boing, 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 zzz, and it goes all the way, drives the green 380 yards, and he's got 10 feet now uphill for eagle on number 1. And the reaction from the broadcast was like, oh, well, that ran out a long way. Oh, boy. Boy, Jordan Spieth there. What a drive there. That was the general tone of the reaction. And I thought to myself, my God, you know what the announcers would have done had Tiger Woods on number 1 driven a 380-yard hole. They might have showed Spieth's drive a second time. Might have. Don't quote me on it. You know if Tiger had done that, they would have shown the drive 4 or 5 times, and they would have gone back to it later in the broadcast. So, yes, there is Tiger bias in that regard, and there's Tiger slurpage, and it's probably just not ever going to be totally corrected for. Couple more emails, then we'll get to our friend Freddie Minnick. Eric Linder writes to say, Zabe, I've been listening to you for a decade from Pennsylvania on various AM/satellite/podcast mediums. Thank you very much for all that. I was listening to you the other day talk about the Arena League team, that'd be the Washington Valor, who has made the Super Bowl of their league, the Arena League, at 2-10. He inserts the, oh, Arena League football sucks.
How come that guy's running backwards? Hey, this is arena football. Didn't you ever hear of a 4-point conversion?
Oh.
Arena football sucks.
He says, I was the coach of my 10-year-old Little League team this year, and we went through the entire season without a single win. But given the entire league makes the playoffs, long story short, yada, 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 we made an improbable run through the quarterfinal, the semifinal, and the league championship game with a stellar regular season record of 0-14. That's how it happens. Even losers can sometimes become champions. This will make the millennial generation feel even more entitled to deserve success despite constant failure. Hashtag champions, I guess. Yeah, I think more and more youth leagues are going to everybody makes the playoffs. In fact, I believe my daughter's high school field hockey playoffs, everybody makes the playoffs because they want a full field. And in general, I'm not theoretically against that, but how do you... You can't justify putting a winless team in the playoffs. There ought to be some cutoff. There ought to be something like, because when you make the playoffs, it's a little accomplishment. You get excited for it. You're like, yay, we made the playoffs. I don't know if these leagues are doing it out of sense of fairness. Like, well, it'd be mean to not invite them to the playoffs. Like, it's rude. It's a party. We got to invite them. Or if they're doing it because they want more robust playoff fields. And in baseball, you ought to, I mean, look, any sport, you ought to be able to beat a team that's 0-14. But being baseball, kids, 10-year-olds, you never know. You never know. And then finally, this one from Rob. He says, Zabe, I just had to show you this article from WyomingDaily.com. You think you know you're merging correctly, but you're probably doing it wrong. It's another article explaining the zipper merge. For those that don't know, Google it. It's basically this. When a lane is closed on a highway, not only are you entitled to every inch of that soon-to-be-closed lane, but in fact, you are supposed to use every inch of that soon-to-be-closed lane until the moment you can no longer use that lane. The pre-merging of people who see that a mile ahead or a half a mile ahead that the lane ends, it's the pre-merging that causes an even greater backup. So when a guy is saying, okay, pre-mergers, I'm going to keep using this lane here, da-da-da-da-da, and then some asshole pulls out suddenly to kind of like, yeah, you know, or a truck will pull out and block you from scooching ahead, they're the assholes. They're doing it wrong because bottom line is that's incorrect. You got to understand the dynamics of traffic, and you got to understand the concept of a zipper merge, and I don't have the resources here to fully explain it. I mean, I could, but who cares? I've already spent too much time on my golf plans and on baseball and on emails. So look it up yourself, zipper merge, and then you will know more. All right, our next guest today, a little bit of an offbeat guest. His name is Fred Mittick. He is a former Army reservist who spent 9 years in Iraq as a staff photographer, served our country beautifully in doing so. And he is now one of the foremost experts on bourbon in America. Wall Street Journal best-selling author. He has written several books, including the one I'm going to quote to you right now. It's called Bourbon Curious, a simple tasting guide for the savvy drinker. He's also written other books such as The Untold Story of How Women Save Bourbon, Scotch, and Irish Whiskey, and many, many more. He has written for Scientific American, Whiskey Advocate, and Whiskey Magazine. He is the bourbon authority for the Kentucky Derby Museum and has appeared on CBS This Morning, Esquire, Forbes, NPR, and many other media outlets. He is Fred Mittick. So how did we get tangled up, Fred? Because we've been doing this dance of, you know, we should have you on to talk bourbon at some point, and it just never happened. Where did we cross paths? I don't remember.
It must be all the bourbon we drink.
Yeah, I wish.
So I was a guest on your show when you were on vacation.
Right, Scott got you on, but you had already reached out to me prior to Scott getting you on. So you were a listener. First of all, Fred, you are in Kentucky,
that's right,
God's country, in the cradle. Mm-hmm. Of the beautiful brown liquor that is bourbon.
It is everywhere you turn. There's a bourbon advertisement or there's a bourbon something.
Right,
I mean,
right.
It is So, it's where I was born. It's where everything happens.
So you used to listen to me on Sporting News Radio, which became Yahoo Sports Radio, which became SB Nation Radio. And then I was gone, and then the boys were back, and then the boys were gone, and then, you know, it all went to pieces. But we're working on our great big comeback. But that's how you started to listen to me. Now, what was it that made you reach out to me regarding your passion and what you do, which is as a bourbon expert? Was I talking about bourbon one day, and was I horribly misinformed? Because I'm guessing I was.
Yeah, you were misinformed about what bourbon was, but you'd always talked about wanting a bourbon barrel. And
that's
I was going to try and help you get a bourbon barrel, because I have some really good friends in D.C. who own distilleries there and have a lot of additional bourbon barrels.
Well, you'll be glad to know that I had a distributor step up and gift me a beautiful specimen of a Buffalo Trace bourbon barrel that proudly sits downstairs in my bar, and it looks absolutely fantastic. So thank you for that.
And that's a good barrel to have.
Oh,
That's a good barrel to have.
No, I love the logo, and I do like the bourbon. But anyway, so at least I hope I was gently and lightly misinformed about bourbon, and not righteously so, because I read in the foreword to your book, Bourbon Curious, about how you often have encounters with people at parties who sometimes just are like, nope, bourbon is this. It's got to be 2 years old, and they are horribly misinformed, but God help them, they are not going to back down from their stance, right?
You broke up a little bit on me there, but if you're referring to the people who just randomly come up to you and then start to tell you like what bourbon is supposed to be, probably the greatest story that I could ever give out of this is that in one of the classes I was giving one time, this old lady comes up to me. She's walking toward me, got her arthritic hips, and she has this cane. I'm thinking she's going to compliment my ascot or, you know, ask me where the bathroom is. And she puts her finger in my chest and she says, "Bourbon has to be made in Kentucky, boy." And I was like, "No, ma'am, that's actually not true. Bourbon can be made anywhere in the United States." And she's like, "You need to get your facts right." And then I pulled an actual bottle that said it was New York. It had New York bourbon on it. I was like, "See right here, you know, this says New York bourbon." She's like, "That ain't bourbon. But it says bourbon." I mean, you know, so she was very stuck in her ways.
So where does that where does that incorrect notion come from?
Well, there was actually a brief time in our country's history where we did consider bourbon to be very unique to Kentucky. And that would have been in the right after the Pure Food and Drug Act under Theodore Roosevelt in 1906, 1907. A lot of people were making fake bourbon all over the country and then putting it on the market. And the government sued those people under the Pure Food and Drug Act for libel, which, as you know, was basically is the written form of slander. And they were saying that in their arguments against these distillers who were doing that, they said bourbon had to be made in Kentucky. So that was like really the only time in our country's history where we said bourbon was unique here. Now, it was born here. It became acclaimed here. But it was that was the only time we ever had any kind of, you know, federal leaning toward it actually being made here. When bourbon becomes a unique product of the United States in 1964, Congress actually got together and declared bourbon to be a unique product. So it cannot be made anywhere else in the world. It has to be made in the United States. That allowed the distillers in Illinois, Indiana, New York, Pennsylvania, allowed them to continue making bourbon. But what
okay.
it did do.
So, yeah. So what it did do, go ahead, finish your thought. And
it, well, I was going to say, what it did do was there were also distillers in Mexico and Canada who were attempting to make bourbon and label it as such. That basically ceased their ability to do so.
Okay. So the misconception mm-hmm. that bourbon has to come from Kentucky actually is born of something that was true 80, 90 years ago, right?
That's absolutely true. Okay. Actually, probably 100 and 10 years ago. About
110
now.
Years ago. Okay, fine. So that's where it comes from. But now it's got to be made in the U.S. So it probably has not stopped Mexico from making what they call bourbon or whiskey. What do they call it since we don't
Yeah, most of those distillers went out of business.
Oh, okay.
You're starting to see a little bit of a comeback from them. But the Kentucky distillers absolutely perpetuated this idea that bourbon had to be made in Kentucky.
Of course.
You know? Yeah. Even now, the Kentucky governor will say 95% of the world's bourbon comes from Kentucky and the rest of it's counterfeit. So it's a little fun kind of tongue-in-cheek thing that they still talk about.
Okay. All right. So let's get the terminology straight. Bourbon, whiskey, scotch. Yep. What's the difference between the three?
All right, so let's do this. Let's look at whiskey as a categorical term. So in the world of spirits, you have spirits that are made from fruits, like grapes.
Okay,
those are brandies.
Wines. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So spirits. when they're distilled,
is wine a spirit? No.
No, wine is a fermented product.
Okay.
So when it's distilled, it is called a brandy.
Beers are fermented, Fred?
Yeah, beers are just fermented.
So beers and wines are fermented. Spirits are distilled.
Spirits will be fermented, and then they will be distilled. And when distilled, they basically go up in proof. The yeast no longer exists, and you know that. That's why you have one shot of whiskey will equal a can of beer.
Okay, so in the distilled realm, mm-hmm. if it's fruit, it'll be a brandy.
It'll be brandy, right? If it's grain, depending how it was distilled, it'll be a whiskey. You know, and to be a whiskey, and this is around the world. It's basically just distilled grain aged in wood. Now, within the whiskey category, you have subcategories. You know, scotch is a type of whiskey. And within scotch, you have single malt, you have single grain, you have blended scotch. And then you go over to the country close to them in Ireland, and, you know, they have Irish whiskey, pure pot still whiskey, blended pot still whiskey. You know, so they have all these different categories within Ireland and in Scotland.
We skipped an important distinction. Scotch has to come from Scotland, period.
Yes, that's
right. There's no Kentucky scotch. If it's scotch, it's from Scotland, and it can be a bunch of different sub-varieties. Then there's Irish whiskey and blended Irish whiskey. And
has to be from Ireland.
Okay, all right. Okay, and, so there we go. So in America, what's the difference between whiskey and bourbon?
So bourbon is a whiskey, but it's a type of whiskey that has to come from a fermented mash of at least 51% corn.
Okay.
It has to be distilled at no higher than 160 proof. And that's really important because vodka, which is odorless and tasteless and it's designed that way, is coming off the still about 190 proof. And so you have the higher you go up in proof off the still, the more you're stripping out of it from a flavor perspective. And bourbon, they obviously have a lot of flavor. They want that flavor there. And it has a regulation standard that it can't go any higher than 160 proof off the still. Now, the reality is like people like Jim Beam, Four Roses, Heaven Hill, Wild Turkey, all these guys are actually in that 130 proof point to 140 proof point coming off the still. Now, that's a little bit of what usually kind of rolls down that gets me going down a geeky highway. So I'll pull back from there.
All right. So basically bourbon is 51% corn.
Yeah. It's always predominantly corn. So that's why that right there separates it from the rest of the whiskeys. Like, so in America, a rye whiskey has to be 51% rye. It's a different standard in Canada, but not to confuse you, Canada has their own laws.
Okay.
But so going back to bourbon, after it comes off the still, it then goes into a new charred oak container. By law, that's what it says in the law, new charred oak container. But in reality, it's a barrel. and it cannot go in that barrel any higher than 125 proof. So they will take it off the still, they will add water to it, and then they will put it in the barrel. And as soon as it touches the barrel, it is considered bourbon. Now, the barrel is the most important aspect of bourbon, 100%. It gets in that barrel, and it starts interacting with that wood. And every day it's in there, it's deep, you know, getting deeper in the wood, penetrating it, and it's getting all those wood sugars pulled out of it, and it's getting all of its color from the barrel. And bourbon producers cannot reuse that barrel. So what they do with them is they sell them to Scotland. They sell them to Ireland, Canada, tequila makers. Even Tabasco is aged in used bourbon barrels for 3 years.
So let me stop you right there. Why can't you reuse a good bourbon barrel?
So this is something that was just kind of practiced, and it became regulation in the 1930s. The cooperage industry, which that's the industry that makes the barrels,
right?
They started seeing the writing on the wall that barrels were not being used as much. Now, they had forklifts, they had ice boxes, they had all these things that people were storing things in. You know, the 1700s and 1800s, the barrel was the forklift of the world. But going into, you know, the 1930s, it was near extinction.
Yeah.
And the only people using it were really alcohol manufacturers.
Okay.
And the cooperage industry saw an opportunity to tie the bourbon industry down, and they ended up getting the bourbon industry to agree to make that a law. So in like
a
19,
law.
Yeah, it's
a
an
law.
Actual law.
No,
actual federal regulation.
Given the billions of dollars at stake, Fred, why on earth hasn't the bourbon industry told the cooper industry, hey, take a hike. We're going to reuse these things because it's going to add 40% to our bottom line or whatever percent it is.
You know, they would actually fight anyone to death if they wanted to change that, because the barrel is what makes them so unique. They don't – that's where they get all of their caramel-rich flavors, a lot of that vanilla, some of those coconuts and chocolates that you get in bourbon.
But other countries are reusing our barrels happily. Now, how many times can a barrel be reused before it loses its
oomph? Well, here's the thing is they're also reselling those. I mean, those barrels will last 80 years before they end up at Lowe's cut in half and in some old lady's front yard.
Planter.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so you get a lot of use out of them.
Okay. But I'm saying, like, we're voluntarily, as a nation, tying ourselves down to one-use barrels for bourbon, not because of anything that says this is what makes the best bourbon. We're doing it to keep the barrel makers in business.
Well, I think that's probably how it started. I mean, I don't think,
but it still is today, right?
Yeah, it still is today.
Okay,
and I think when you look at changing, because the distillers have changed many laws, they're very influential.
I would imagine
not as influential as they used to be, but they're still influential. But if they wanted to change that, you know, they probably could.
Okay,
but
so
it really.
So anyway,
it
so
really does make an impact.
All right. So and now I understand one of the hot new things is to distill bourbon or to age bourbon in someone else's barrel, a wine barrel, for example, from France or some other spirit, so it gets a little cross-pollination.
Yeah, actually a highly controversial subject in the bourbon world. You might say it's a designated hitter of whiskey in some ways.
Yeah.
A lot of people are against that, you know, because the law is very clear that it needs to be in virgin oak. But there's this ongoing debate that it is bourbon, but then they finish it in a port barrel or a cognac barrel or a wine barrel.
Right.
And that just gives it some additional flavor. And I personally really love those products, like Angel's Envy is a good one. Bellamead has a really nice sherry cask finish. I personally love them, but I do wish that we could clean up the labeling a little bit, because it's pretty, and you know, and the governing body that regulates alcohol labeling is an arm under the Treasury. It's called the TTB.
Yeah.
And they do a piss poor job of making sure things, you know, get properly regulated. If you distilled a can of shit, they would probably approve it for vodka. So
All right, let's take a quick break here. By the way, if you want to know more, excellent book and a beautiful, beautiful printed hardcover. I'm holding it in my hands. Bourbon Curious, A Simple Tasting Guide for the Savvy Drinker by Fred Minnick, who is talking to us right now. And also you have a book called Bourbon, The Rise, the Fall, and Rebirth of an American Whiskey. We'll get into some of those issues in just a second. But let's throw one more wrinkle into the mix. Jack Daniels. Is Jack Daniels a bourbon?
Probably the most controversial question that we get. the thing is, it is absolutely bourbon.
But and they don't call it that. They call it Tennessee sipping whiskey, don't they?
Yeah, this all goes back to trying to have a market separation. You know, Tennessee is trying to separate itself from Kentucky and the whiskey marketplace, and they're actually very equal in terms of quality, like going into the 1930s and 1940s.
Right.
And they're both on that pedestal of American whiskey. And what you saw was that Tennessee was trying to separate itself based on something historical that they've used in their processes called the Lincoln County process. And that's where they actually filter the spirit through maple charcoal before it goes into the barrel. So it gets a kind of a filtration set before it's ever put in the barrel. Now, the federal government will not grant them any kind of special designation. And so when we have free trade agreements, they will actually refer to Tennessee whiskey as a straight bourbon made in Tennessee. So
this is so comically complex. It's a straight bourbon made in Tennessee, but it's not technically this. That said, Jack Daniels is the top dog, right? In terms of volume.
Yeah they're the number one selling whiskey in the world, even over Johnny Walker.
Okay.
And you know, it's an amazing distillery too. If you've never been, it's incredible.
Who's number 2, 3, 4 amongst the big boys? Just so roughly speaking, you don't have to give me up to date.
In American whiskey or all whiskeys?
Let's go American first, then we'll go overseas.
Okay. So when we look at the entire American portfolio, it's Jack Daniels, Jim Beam, Evan Williams, Maker's Mark, Wild Turkey.
Okay.
So those would be the top five. And then kind of getting in the mix are brands like Bullet, Knob Creek, maybe. You'd see, you know,
Woodford Reserve.
Yeah, Woodford's going to be right in that mix. After number five, it's a kind of changes all the time.
I bet the pie chart gets to be very thin little slices. But a lot of those makers are trying to go for their little niche, and I'm sure they're carving them out. Okay.
Well, what's interesting is the category some of those I just gave you, some of them were owned by one company. So you have
right.
So you have a little bit of like having two horses in the race and using one to block the other. Here's a funny story. The bourbon business is all about characters and has all these people who have been at each other's throats in a friendly manner for generations. In the 1980s and 1990s, Maker's Mark was trying to grow, and they were taking pot shots at Jack Daniels. They actually found a guy in the South. His name was Jack Daniels, and they hired him, and they put him in all these ads holding Maker's Mark, and they dressed him up just like the Jack Daniels. And they said, look, Jack Daniels loves Maker's Mark. And so Brown-Forman, the parent company of Jack Daniels, after all of these efforts by Maker's Mark, said, please, somebody get a bourbon to compete with Maker's Mark to get him off our back. And that bourbon ended up being Woodford Reserve.
Wow.
So, and now it's one of the top-tier brands in
so in other words, Jack Daniels, the big dog, said, okay, you want to fuck with us? Great, watch. We're going to make a bourbon that's going to start mowing your yard on the bourbon side of things, Because you wouldn't shut your mouth about, oh, look, we got Jack Daniels and he loves this. Blah, 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 blah. All right, let's go overseas to Scotland. What are the top scotches?
Scotch is very heavily. So you have your single malt category, which that's Glenlivet and Glenfiddich are going to be your top two.
The Glens, as we call them. And is single malt the more expensive of them? Is it considered the higher end, the snobbier of these?
Yeah,
spirits?
It tends to be. I mean, okay. Those some of the great single malts, like from Macallan.
Yep.
You know, they can go at auction up to $1 million. I mean, they spend stupid money on some of that stuff.
Why are some of those single malt scotches in the liquor store, why are they so expensive? A couple hundred dollars a bottle, which I would never buy because my tastes and my passion are just not that extreme. Why are they so expensive? Does it cost more to make?
Yeah, a lot of those older scotches have been sitting in a warehouse for 30, 40 years.
Oh, that's right. It's the amount of years they're aged. Yeah. So you're buying the number of years, basically.
See, in Kentucky, you really... You know, it's hot here, it's cold here, and you got the new barrels. You don't need as much time to get to achieve a quality, you know, product that you want. Whereas in Scotland, they're in used barrels, one, and it's basically the same damn temperature all year round. And so you don't have as much, you know, effort pushing it in the wood, if you will, from nature.
Right. And then the Irish do their own thing, and they've got Jameson's, and I'm sure that's a good...
Yeah, but actually in Scotland, the two number, you know, the top ones would be Chivas Regal, and Johnny Walker would be number one.
Got it.
So, and that's a blend. Okay. But yeah, in Ireland, Jameson, Bushmills, from a quality perspective, Redbreast is probably the best, is probably the best whiskey you can find on a normal basis. And I always look for like Redbreast 12-year-old, 15-year-old.
Nice.
I mean, there's some really beautiful expressions from that brand.
All right, so let's bring it back to the States here. One of the anecdotes you have in your book is about how when you sat down and talked to the owner of Bullet Rye, Bullet, B-U-L-L-E-I-T, but
yeah,
it's
Bullet.
Pronounced
mm-hmm.
Bullet. The founder's name that you sat down with again was?
Yeah, Tom Bullet.
Tom Bullet, okay. Mm-hmm. He said, look, a lot of what goes on in this, you know, whiskey and bourbon game, it's not what's necessarily in the glass. It's what's surrounding the brand. He sort of admitted to you that the marketing is carrying the day on a lot of these brands. Not that the bourbon's not good, and not that you don't have your preferences, but you got to have a bit of a story. You got to have a bit of a hook, a bit of an angle, right?
Yeah, and... I mean, it goes all the way down to the, like, who commands these companies. You're looking at, like, when you're looking at the actual bottle cost, like, when it comes down to everything, 75% of all the money spent is on marketing. They also have, like, a big tax thing that they have to pay. But marketing kind of runs the world right now in spirits. I think it really started with Grey Goose. You had Mr. Frank who went down, who said to somebody, he's like, get me a high-end vodka in France, and he put it in that fancy package, and he kind of changed the game. I mean, he changed the game for vodka and opened the door for someone like Tito's, who is actually, you know, he calls himself handcrafted and everything, but, you know, that's a matter of, like, he's been acquiring distillate from other people and then redistilling it there in Texas. So you have a lot of questionable practices in all forms of spirits.
You know, I know that Tito's is a hot brand right now, and I'm not really into vodka, which is fine. Some people are. Whenever I hear Tito's handcrafted vodka, I just chortle thinking, what in the fuck does that mean? Handcrafted.
Yeah.
Is he sitting there with a hammer pounding on a puddle of vodka to hammer it into just the right taste? Like, get out of here with that. Handcrafted. Yeah. I don't drink that machine tilled vodka. That stuff's swill. I want mine handcrafted. But it's brilliant marketing, right?
It's brilliant marketing. It's also language that's very common you know, right now. And it, the things like small batch, handcrafted, that just, for whatever reason, people.
Private just, reserve, that kind of
they
stuff.
They just completely ignore their senses and like, oh, this is supposed to be good.
Ooh. Exactly, yeah. Right. Well, look, I am myself, Fred, a sucker for the marketing, because basically I will like pretty much any vodka, or excuse me, any bourbon, any whiskey, any scotch, whatever, in the appropriate quantities. I don't necessarily have my favorites, but I like certain bottles and the way they look sitting on my bar shelf. And so yeah. Little things like, what's the one with the horsey on the top?
Blanton's.
Yeah, Blanton's, okay. Mm-hmm. That's an expensive one. I usually don't buy it. My brother's bought me a couple bottles. I'm like, ooh, I love the little horsey on the top. You know, Maker's Mark with the poured on wax over the top. I'm like, that's kind of cool right there. It's got the bottle's got to look good for me, you know, for me to want to put it up on the shelf.
Yeah, you know, they are pieces of art. You know, and there's a lot of effort that goes into the bottles, and there's a lot of effort that goes into the whiskey. And you have they sit there and you see that kind of like shimmering russet color or amber hues. And sometimes in the right light, there'd be like a hint of like red coming out of the corner with the liquid.
Right.
And then you see like you fill the glass and they feel like art, unless you pick up something at the bottom shelf like Old Crow, and then it just feels like alcoholism. But you know, you just gotta know what to get.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about, when did bourbon make a comeback of sorts? Because it seems like it wasn't as chic. I mean you couldn't have gone to a place. Listen to you. Are you pouring one right now? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, yes, I am, actually.
I heard the poof. Can you get that? Can you do that again, Fred, close to your phone? I want to hear that. Shush. Here we go.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna have to drink a little more now.
Poor guy. Ah, yes. I love it.
That worked for you?
I love it. So bourbon is very chic now, and there are bourbon bars that have cropped up all over the place. This is only in the last 20 years, right, that this has been kind of a hot liqueur?
Yeah. It's actually kind of sad when you look back to what happened to bourbon. You know, I talked about 1964. That's the year that the bourbon breaks out, and it's like it's the moment, you know. It's its own unique spirit of the United States. It couldn't be a more proud moment for the category. And that's when vodka starts hitting the scenes and starts taking away market share. You know, the hippie generation stops drinking vodka or stops drinking bourbon. And the bourbon distillers really don't know how to react to that. So they start trying to compete with vodka in their space. The distillers are not necessarily diversified, so they're caught flat-footed. And they start closing. They start losing jobs. And you had longtime families like the Van Winkles and the Farnsley selling Stitz of Weller in 1972. You see, you know, longtime distilleries like Old Taylor close in the 70s. You see the Willets start have to change a little bit. And it's a really depressing time, the 60s and 70s. And by the time the 1980s roll around, you're seeing a category that's just dead. I mean, it's behind like cream liqueurs, gin, tequila. I mean, there's everything but everything's ahead of it. I mean, it's not a good time. And so when bourbon's at its worst, the worst absolute moment, you had people like Booker No, which coincidentally I'm drinking Booker's right now. Booker No and Elmer T. Lee and Parker Beam and Jimmy Russell. These guys started, you know, kind of re-challenging, you know, the category. They come up with things like the commercially available single barrel and small batch. And suddenly someone in Japan gets thirsty for it. And Japan becomes this crazy market where they'll just drink anything the American distillers send their way. I mean, they're drinking Jack Daniels, Maker's Mark, Rebel Yale. You had companies creating entire new brands just to market to Japan. That's how Blanton's was created. Was it was created to really meet the needs of the Japanese market.
So basically, our friends, the Japanese, who get passionate about certain things. And when the Japanese get crazy about something, they're all into it, man. So they get crazy about bourbon, and they help lift the category straight out of the muck on its path.
That was the one growing region. You had brands doing well, like Knickerbocker was doing well, Wild Turkey was doing well, but it was really Japan that was creating distiller enthusiasm. And so you had all of these initiatives in the early 1990s ready to just take Japan by storm. That's why the Small Batch series was created by Jim Beam. It was to capture Japan. And then their market tanked, and everybody started getting really, really nervous. A company called United Distillers, now Diageo, they decided to actually sell off their American whiskey interests. They sell off all their stocks. They sell their brands like Weller to people like Sazerac and Heaven Hill, who received Old Fitzgerald. And also the actual whiskey. They sold the actual whiskey stocks that would be used to create brands like Pappy Van Winkle, Jefferson's, and some of the more iconic brands of the 90s. And
so when did it become popular in America?
That's about the time.
What year is this?
It's really about the time when the internet starts taking off. Okay. I mean, there are bourbon
late 90s
social media groups before there's Facebook and even AOL chat room.
Okay.
And so you had people convening in Kentucky in the late 90s, getting together in the early 2000s, and then the millennials hit the stage. The millennials drink a lot of bourbon. The women drink a lot of bourbon. And so now we're looking at the very first time in history, we're looking at every single generation drinking bourbon. And it really starts with our ability to communicate with one another with what the fuck we're drinking.
Right. And to be a little bit of a bourbon snob, a little bit of a bourbon nerd, and to not cross over, Fred, into being a bourbon douchebag, which is tough, because anytime something gets popular and a lot of people are into it, it's very easy to cross over. So we're in a golden age of bourbon. Can we say that?
Yeah, we're in a golden age of bourbon and bourbon consumers. What happens to the douchebags is they get put a check quicker than a hockey player. Because let me tell you something. You get something wrong in bourbon and people will tell you. They will call you out and they're like, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Right.
You know, and they're not trolls. I mean, they're like lawyers. They're like doctors.
Yeah, they're rabid. They'll be like, okay, pal, you think you know your bourbon? I'm going to stuff you into a barrel, and you're not going to forget it. What about those that are the ones that go, oh, don't put it over ice. That ruins it. Just straight sipping whiskey right out of the glass. Or some people will recoil in horror if you dare to cut it with anything other than just ice. And I've heard other people say, hey, man, drink your bourbon or whiskey however you like it. Where do you stand?
I think that's an ongoing debate for me. You know, I have my limits. Like, you know, if you paid $5,000 for a whiskey and then you put it over Coke, I mean, I'm going to cringe at that. But I mean, at the end of the day,
agreed. It makes no sense. But let's say,
but at the end of the day, it's your money. Yeah.
Well, see, here's what I used to be. I used to be a guy that always put whatever it was over Diet Coke. But then I started to say, okay, let me just pour this over the rocks and let me just sip on it. And so now I'll go both ways. Like sometimes, you know, depending on what I've got, sometimes I will cut it with something. A lot of times I won't. And so I'm kind of growing in that regard. I also, Fred, went and invested, like a douchebag, in the giant square ice, you know, silicone ice makers.
So no, I that's put cool, actually.
One, is that
that's
cool? That's cool. Not douchey? Okay.
And that's cool.
Yeah, okay, and so I put a big old rock in there, and I'm like, yeah, here's some bourbon. Not on the rocks, bourbon on the rock, my one big cube. And then, because I was getting nerdy, I was like, I'd love to be able to make ice that is perfectly clear. And I went down this rabbit hole in the internet where I realized it's actually a science trick that requires sort of specialized equipment to do that.
Yeah. That's pretty cool that you went through all that.
I think you can buy like these things that create perfectly clear ice cubes, but they're like these little encasements that let the air bubbles that are trapped in the water gently filter to the top, and then you kind of peel it out. And as soon as I saw what they were and how much they cost, I'm like, nah, I don't need to do that. So
I'll say this. Like, I was the longtime critic for Whiskey Advocate. I'm no longer with them because I'm starting my own magazine called Bourbon Plus.
Nice.
But when I reviewed things, I had a policy to review it as they bottled it. I mean, if I was of interest at the moment to add some water, I would, but I would not let that be my lead taste for the review. So, and I'm doing other things too, where I'm still reviewing stuff, but I think that policy will always hold true for me, including these competitions I'm a judge in. I'm a judge on the San Francisco World Spirits Competition, and the glass is presented to me, and I have, as a judge, as a critic, you know, I have to taste the spirit for how it was bottled. You know, I can't adulterate it to my taste,
right.
You know, so you have to, I think every bottle of bourbon will be different.
Yeah.
You know, I actually, there's some bourbons I want to mix with ginger ale, and they're fantastic bourbons by themselves, but to me, they're like perfect in ginger ale.
Yeah.
Jack Daniels, there's not a better whiskey in the world than Coca-Cola, in my opinion. It just, because there's a banana note in there that stands out. You can really taste the banana. It fits really nicely with the Coca-Cola.
Oh, don't ruin Jack Daniels for me saying there's banana in there. Now, because that's my banana is my arch nemesis when it comes to tastes and fruits. So I'm going to pretend like you didn't say that. The book is called Bourbon Curious, A Simple Tasting Guide for the Savvy Drinker. Fred Minnick is the author. He has written a follow-up book called Bourbon, Rise and Fall and Rebirth of an American Whiskey. You see him all over the place, or at least you should, on television. And it's just great what you've done. I love it. Now, the next thing we're going to have to do is when you're in D.C., we got to get a meetup, me, you, and some of my listeners, and we will sample some bourbons and some whiskeys.
Well, there's a great place there called Jack Rose. It's the world's best whiskey bar. If you've never been there, it's in the DuPont Circle area.
Yes, we did a remote at a bourbon bar, but it was not Jack Rose. It was another one. I can't remember its name. Owner was very nice. They had a very good selection, not as big as the Jack Rose selection, but still, we got our places to do it. So I look forward to it, Freddie. It's been great to hook up with you. This was just an introductory course. We'll loop back for some advanced studies, I'm sure, in the future, okay?
Hey, one thing I've got coming up that you've got to know about, and I want you to come down to, it's called Bourbon and Beyond.
Okay.
September 21st and 22nd in Louisville, Kentucky. I curate all the bourbon there and the seminars. You'd be my guest, but Sting, Robert Plant, John Mayer, Lenny Kravitz, you know, those are the musicians. And there's a lot of celebrity chefs there, but there's a huge, huge, huge bourbon component. And if you want to come down, you know, bring a listener or two or something, I'd love to have you.
It's a very nice invite, Fred. I'm going to aspire to be there. How about that?
And you got to tell me what you're drinking so we can get you on the path of elitism.
Okay. You know what? I will start cataloging what I actually bring home. I literally go every now and then to the ABC store here in Virginia, where, you know, the government officials have their thumb on the high-end spirits and the taxation of said items. And I just look for bottles that are nice, and I look for ones that are nicely shaped, and I'm like, yeah, I kind of like this, I kind of like that, and I just go with that. But yeah, I'll start cataloging it, and I'll actually start taking some notes as to what I really do like and what I don't like. How about that?
All right, man. I'll be your coach.
All right, very good. Fred, thanks for your time as always, bud.
Oh, it's my pleasure, sir.
Let's end on this today. Santa Barbara, California has enacted the most draconian anti-straw law in the country. According to Reason Magazine, it's easily the most severe ban and the most severe penalties put on the books for, yes, handing out evil plastic straws to customers at restaurants. There is a $1,000 fine and a potential for up to a year in jail for giving out a straw at a restaurant. That's right. It's now a law in Santa Barbara, California, where I went to college. straw could, if you're a waiter, you give out a straw, could be a year in jail. I mean, it's just amazing. Seattle banned plastic straws earlier this month, banning a $250 fine for violators, but they did not add the potential for imprisonment. Not only has Santa Barbara banned plastic straws, they've also banned compostable straws. Oh, and each individual straw that you hand out potentially counts as a separate infraction, meaning if you give out four straws to a family of four, you could be going to jail for 4 years. This is insanity. We are living in insane times. Because it's straws today, what will it be tomorrow? Oh, don't be ridiculous with that slippery slope theory. Oh, really? Here it is. We're sliding down the roof of common sense society like Clark Griswold putting up Christmas lights in Christmas Vacation. Don't you see it? Straws today, something else tomorrow. Now, here's my question. Could somebody deftly counter this move with an ADA lawsuit, an Americans with Disabilities Act lawsuit? I'm thinking an armless man is the perfect guy to challenge the straw ban in Santa Barbara, California. An armless man who is very, very thirsty. How would he not have a very strong case that under the Americans with Disabilities Act that he is entitled to a straw? And if a guy who's armless is allowed a straw under the ADA, then what about somebody who just claims, well, I just had rotator cuff surgery on my right arm and I really don't want to lift my drink. I just want to... I know this. I have my older daughter, Catherine, who is on the spectrum, special needs daughter. She always asks for a straw in restaurants. Why? Because she doesn't like drinking. I mean, she can drink out of a cup. She doesn't like it, though. It's a tactile thing. You know, she didn't want the ice slapping around her lips and possibly spilling. Maybe she spilled early on as a kid and realized, nah, this is no good. Always asked for a straw. This is always a big deal. I mean, if this thing takes off, I can just only imagine. And now we're going to have to pack a straw. Family's going to have to pack our own special straw and clean the straw. How long before using a straw is illegal? Even if it's your own straw, it's made out of gold. And it costs $100 or more. And you're going to take it home with you and not pollute the nearby rivers, lakes, streams, or whatever. How long before they go, no, that's illegal too? Well, why? Well, just because it is, because we hate straws. Who knows? Find me that armless man and get Alan Dershowitz on the phone, and we'll beat this thing. That'll be a wrap for today. You know the drill. Tell two friends. Hit up that Reddit thread about how great this thing is. Leave a positive review and rating. Forgive my golf trips, which are now coming here in the next couple weeks. Hang in there. Football season is coming. And always remember... coaches who don't go for it on 4th and less than 10 inside the 50 are chicken shit. Period. Amen. End of story. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.